Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
I'm Walt.
Yeah, there he is. So this week, we told you we'd have, who knows how many we might end up getting to the end of this and deciding to talk more about some other stuff. Because Walt's got some stories. That's for damn sure. We have returning guest, Walt. And for those of you who go way, way back on the show, I will tell a story that I think is kind of funny, is that I have known Walt since I was in high school, and he was the officer assigned to my high school, and he caught my sister ditching.
That's hilarious.
So that's how I met Walt. Then subsequent to me becoming a cop, we got to know each other, you know, differently as adults and professionals. Walt helped mentor me through that whole process, along with some other, he was one of the instrumental guys. I call him my other dad or my uncle Walt, because there's a lot of us young guys. He was like that, you know, wizened old uncle who knew a lot of stuff as a mentor, but goddamn, he was fun to hang around with too. So at least in your younger days.
Yeah, I bet.
So Walt's back on. Last time he was on the show, for those of you that go way, way back, he talked about spending his time in the Air Force guarding aircraft that were designated to hit the tarmac and respond in a nuclear emergency. But we didn't really talk about your time in the police department. So welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show, Walt, my friend and Chuck's friend, because
that's true.
The same day we did Walt's episode, we did two episodes in one day that day. The same way we recorded Walt's episode, we also recorded Chuck's first episode of the podcast. And
anniversary
guest
John had booked Chuck, and I had booked Walt. And when Walter walked in and Chuck walked out, we ran into each other in the door. I know that asshole. You guys were familiar with each other at, through law enforcement circles. You'd met it through the job at some point. And then it was just sheer coincidence that I happened to have known Walt for a decade or more. And then John happened to have known you since childhood. And then you and Walt happened to have met and run into each other through working in law enforcement. And correct. Yet we didn't know that you knew each other.
But I still had my hair then. I was still growing some hair.
You still had some hair. I wouldn't.
Dr. Phil still has hair.
But I still had a
mustache. Doesn't mean it was on the top of your head.
Yeah, you still had the Teddy Roosevelt mustache going on.
Yeah. When I met him, I actually had a pretty killer stash at the time. But yeah, I met him through mutual aid, and he was
one that Ron Jeremy version. Would be jealous of.
Well, better true. Than Ron Jeremy.
Oh yeah. So I knew Walt for a little bit prior to coming on, and I was like, oh, that's crazy. Through mutual aid and stuff like that, through law enforcement, been on some similar calls, and things like that. And it's just wild that when I started this podcast with you, Tom, almost over 3 years ago now, I think 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, you started the podcast right before, like maybe a year before I moved is when you started really taking over as co-host. I think that was the beginning of 2020.
Yeah,
and I
2024.
Moved.
So
So
4 years. Yeah. Fucking wild, dude. And it's crazy thing is that if you really think back about it, like this podcast has been running for over fucking 6 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And when I came on and I saw Walt, it was 5 years ago, something like that.
So it's been a minute from Walt being on the show.
So much crap has happened since then.
Right? Yeah, you're not even on the job anymore. Happy retirement, Walt.
Yes, thank you. Trying.
And you're not a California resident anymore.
No, thank God.
Which one are you happy about? Not being a retired cop or being an ex-Californian?
You know, we always say I miss the monkeys, but I don't miss the circus. And some of the most greatest people I've ever worked with and been around were just solid people. The bureaucracy I could do without, the headaches and stuff, and all the drama that I personally endured over the last 7 years, which is kind of ironic. They did so much to hurt me, certain people, but at my last 5 years were like a blessing in disguise, you know, working detectives for the last 5 years, and it was just heaven. Heaven.
Well,
that's awesome.
I mean, if you get to work dicks for the last 5 years of your career, that's not too bad. I mean, some people do their whole career and never get to work dicks. So,
well, you know, when I went to the detective school, the Robert Presley Institute, the 2-week school.
No free commercials.
Go ahead. Okay, whatever. I guess because of all my experience too, but I was a top student. I had a 99.9% score on everything.
And if there's one thing Walter has always been proud of since I've known him, it's his academic achievements. You have not been, since I've known you, and I was in school, I was in high school when I met you, and you have never not been going to college in some way, shape, or form, whether it's trying to get an advanced degree or changing your major or, you know, whatever it is. You are a lifelong student. You've always been.
Oh yeah, well,
knowledge life, is power.
Every day is a lifelong learning experience. Right now, I'm learning how to bend over and put my shoes and socks on. But
well, you've been talking like Buddha since I've known you, but now you're starting to look more and more like Buddha.
Thank you.
The crazy thing is knowing what agency that Walt works for and how much they screwed with him, and then they gave him that nice spot to keep him safe in detectives. If my agency would have just came to me and been like, hey, we know you're hurt, we'll let you work in, you know, with the detectives and things like that, and we'll take care of you, I never would have thought about medical retirement. It's just it's interesting how times have shifted and agencies are not one of like they used to be anymore.
Well, and it depends how much wood you have on them.
But you know, the thing is, I was transferred.
Walter knows where a lot of bodies are buried.
That's true, but I was admin transferred from West Valley to Topanga, and a lot of the core people that when Topanga opened 15 years ago, the core people that were there were all old West Valley people.
And just so you know, he's talking about two divisions within the Los Angeles Police Department that are out in like the suburbs of LA for the.
They used to be the same division.
Yes. So when I went out there, these guys were like, hey, welcome to Panga. We always welcome our own. You're part of our family already. So then I'm like, okay, well, what shift am I going to work? Like, oh no, we got something for you. And I go, what do you mean? Like, oh, go see Detective Myers and over in Burgundy, and she'll tell you what you're going to do. And life was golden after that.
Yeah. And I mean, you had never done a dedicated detective spot up to that point, right?
No, I had worked as a detective's adjutant for the commanding officer of the detectives. And I did some investigations, you know, internal affairs crap, but no, that was as a case carrying investigator, that was my first and only gig.
Now, Walter is also unique in that he was born in the wrong time. Now I'm going to clue you.
I was born in the wrong time. You were
Walter
born
doesn't
time.
Know which time he should have been born in. He's gone through a couple of different phases in his life.
Maybe some past life regression. Yeah.
Right. When I met you, you were working through some 1865 stuff.
Yeah.
1860, 1865,
that era. Well, 1940 was always my favorite time.
Right. So then I come on the job and I know that all of a sudden you've grown up a bit and you're working through some maybe 1941, 1942, 1943 stuff.
Yeah.
And then when you got assigned to detectives, it was no surprise to me that all of a sudden you were carrying a wheel gun and wearing a fedora.
Bro, I'm going to stop you right there. Tom, Walt should have been born in like the 1900s, 1920s. Cause have you ever seen his like 1920 era copper uniform with the
yes.
old school fucking
yes,
wheel gun? Yep. Oh my God. That shit is the freaking straight pipe, freaking wooden baton, the old OG.
Wow. I carried one of those.
Freaking shop. Well, yeah, but you got to understand that the agency that he was portraying, they completely modernized everything. And it, dude.
Oh, no, I've
if seen those guys could carry straight sticks. Holy fuck. People would be fucked up.
It's like a baseball bat, dude.
Like I said, so Walter is one of those guys. He's like, if you were to come across him on a college campus, you might mistake him for the history professor or for a Teddy Roosevelt impersonator that's there to do a topical talk in your college history class.
Oh my gosh.
So I just wanted to paint the picture for people that don't know Walter. He's a unique individual who in some ways you're very not like a typical cop. And then in other ways you are 100% like prototypical cop. You know, you've always created that persona for yourself of being a man from out of time and wanting thump people on the head the old school way.
Well, what they call order maintenance policing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer in order maintenance.
Yeah.
Can you explain that for people who don't know what that is?
So there was I think it's broken down into four phases, but order maintenance and policing is like the early policing styles where the best example I can give you is if say we're in New York City in a very high dense populated area, there'd be cops walking a beat, and those cops knew their clientele, the people on the beat, correct?
Yep. You
know, their neighbors,
yeah,
true. The merchants, yep. Everything, the kids, the thugs, all that stuff. And so order maintenance is the idea that you prevent the crime from happening in the first place by knowing who the troublemakers are, keeping them in line. And you know, if that meant, you know, racking some get on the knuckles or mm-hmm. you know,
whacking them over the head with a shillelagh,
giving them a nudge. Yeah, it
zap.
Right. It was
acceptable.
It was encouraged, acceptable. Even to the bad guy, it was acceptable because that's the price of mouthing off or not complying.
So well, and they used to know that.
So the copper could stand on the corner and he could so you have this era. So you have the order maintenance, which is, it's sort of it kind of goes across a lot of different eras. And then you had a political era, which was the early policing, where it's who you knew, you paid for your promotion, you paid to get on the job, like in Boston, like New York, like Chicago, mm-hmm. you paid mm-hmm. for the lieutenant's test, you know, and stuff like that. And then they got to like what they call the professional era, which is like when Parker came in and
William H. Parker. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically eliminated a lot of the graft and a lot of the corruption, a lot of the favoritism.
Right. You couldn't buy badges to get out of tickets.
Right. And yeah, I just sold a juice badge, by the way.
What's that?
Series 5.
A juice badge is a badge that was issued by the chief of police to somebody who was a friend of the department. And so if they were tight with the chief would give them a badge that they could get whatever they wanted on these badges. The chief would put all kinds of crazy, like special advisor
privileges.
Right. And so you would flash this badge and the captain or the cop or the sergeant
would go away.
I've seen those.
Go away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen those from California Highway Patrol. I pulled
so the California Highway Patrol had a very similar program badge. With what's the it's the 1199 Foundation, I believe, and it's
their 1199 it's their Foundation.
Benevolent fund. Benevolent. But if you gave $10,000, I don't know what it is now, the benevolent fund, they issued you a little wallet with a tiny badge that said "Friend of the CHP."
These were even better, though.
No, I know. I'm just saying that it's the same concept. Yeah.
Los Angeles detectives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, if you have more, I'll buy one.
Well, no, they're expensive.
No, yeah.
They're relics now among the police.
I just paid a bunch of bills with the money I made off of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. got it. Yeah. More than I can afford. Yeah.
So to follow up on that, after the professional era, you have the, you know, you have basically order maintenance going on through these different eras. The concept of maintaining order. If that copper's on the block and he sees some young punks that are sitting on a stoop up to no good, well, you know, little grandma, you know, is going to walk to the store to go to groceries and come back. You know, in the order maintenance era, you tell those guys to move along. And now what we have is called the due process model. And in due processes, they'd rather let the old grandma get robbed and then go arrest the guy instead of preventing the robbery in the first place.
Right. And so just so everybody's aware, because if we stay too long on this, Walt is a police amateur police historian in a lot of ways, and he will.
Oh, I'm on the board of the police museum as well.
See, so that's fucking awesome. I'll add that my dad said this a long time ago in a much simpler way, and I didn't know it was order maintenance policing. I just knew it as police work. My dad said, "Son, your job is, the world is full of dipshits and assholes. Your job is to keep them apart, because dipshits can't do anything to dipshits, and who cares if assholes do anything to assholes? But you can't let the dipshits and the assholes together, or bad things will happen." And I said, okay. So that was the concept behind it. So now what we thought, we talked to you about a story, and this is hard to explain. So Chuck, you know, one of the officers involved in this story, you know who it is?
I do. Yeah.
Right. And so we know what happens, but this is not the officer's story. We don't have permission from that officer to discuss his part in it. So we're not going to discuss his part in it until we have him retired, or he doesn't give a shit and he wants to come on and tell his version of events. But what I thought we would tell you is what the incident was and how you have to respond to a critical incident as a supervisor. So maybe for some of you guys that are getting ready to take sergeant's test, or maybe some of you guys out there listening to the show are supervisors or whatever, you can hear and learn something about being a supervisor at an agency that arguably doesn't know how to handle supervision very well.
Very astute observation there, Thomas.
Yeah. But
it's supervision by intimidation.
For some of you guys that are listening to this, that are your good street cops, and you want some insight into the mind of the people that are thinking about the incident from the 30,000 foot view as a supervisor that are responding to it, this will give you some of that insight.
Right.
So the floor is yours.
Yeah. Really quick before we start, this can be a treat because like you said, I know the officer who is involved. In a shooting. And I heard his side of it briefly, you know, as much as he would like to share, just shooting the shit one day. And so it's going to be interesting to hear it from one of his direct supervisors roles. So it's going to be interesting. So it's a good treat for me.
Yeah. So, okay. Without further ado, I thought we'd start with what the actual incident, the Reader's Digest version of what transpired, and then talk us through how it comes out. Cause luckily you actually brought us some of the audio that you had recorded.
Accidentally.
So, yeah. Accidentally.
Surreptitiously.
Yeah. So talk us through just the general bones of the actual incident itself, as if you were giving us a police briefing log, and then we'll go through your experiences during the incident.
Okay. So I was the watch commander, which is basically the person in charge of the police station for that day shift of that day. Our captains were, one was out of town, and I think one was covering for the area captain. And so my lieutenant was the acting captain. So it was just me and a couple of supervisors out working supervision that day. And I was just doing my thing. And, you know, there's a lot of miscellaneous, you know, paperwork to, you know, like logs and audits and report reviews and stuff, you know, in my inbox basket. And so we have an officer assigned to the station, and it sometimes it rotates. It usually does rotate. And the officer, they call him the kit room officer. And that's the guy who hands out the shotguns and car keys to the shops, which is a police car. And on this particular day, I wasn't really paying much attention to what was going on in the field at that moment. But that particular day, the Kirim officer comes up to me and says, "Hey, an incident just came out over on Balcom. If they ask for a rifle officer, can I go?" And I'm like, "Yeah, okay, yeah. Let's see how things pan out, and I'll let you know." So then a few, you know, few minutes go by, and nothing gets resolved. We don't hear anything back. Code 4 that everything's under control.
Was that so, before rifles were allowed in the field?
No, they did. No, this is when rifles were allowed, but you would have to call for Code Robert. You know,
right?
That's right. So yeah. Or UPR, whatever they want to, you know, whatever name.
It's Code Robert.
So
from what I've read.
So then I'm doing my thing. I end up going out in the lobby and talking to somebody else. And that's when I inadvertently turned on my tape recorder. So that'll kind of lead up to this. So what happened was this guy, they called him the Jesus twin, Eric Leibowitz. He had just been released from a 5150 mental health hold where he was, you know, involuntarily held for 48 hours.
Yeah. Danger to himself, danger to others, or gravely disabled.
Exactly. So he's back at this house that he's renting on Balcom, which is in a little small community in Encino, where very small houses that, you know, were built back in the 50s. You know, it's still a nice community. You know, it's very, very low crime and very upscale, actually, compared to the rest of the valley. But so he's here. I'll run it the way I understood it. This guy is on the opposite street, and he's watering his back lawn, and he's watering his lawn, and he gets closer to the fence, and he looks in the bushes, and he sees a shotgun laying there. And then this guy Leibowitz pops his head up over the fence and says, "Hey, sir, can I have my shotgun back? My girlfriend was visiting,
what?
And I didn't want her to know that I had it." So the guy's like, "Oh, okay," and he hands him back the shotgun. Well, a few minutes later, the neighbor hears boom in the house.
Shit.
A shotgun. He's like, oh my goodness, what did I just do? So he called the police. So the police respond to Jameson Avenue, which is the opposite street. And they meet with the, I'm going to read this thing from the LA Times real quick. So to kind of, according to LAPD press statement, officers with LAPD West Valley responded to a call of shots fired in the 5800 block of Jameson, but they were later directed to Balcom, one street over. Okay. So,
got it.
So then a few minutes go by and it hasn't been resolved yet. So I ask somebody to print out the incident from our command console computer. So I start to read this thing. I'm like, oh my goodness, it's time for me to go. So I grab the Kirim officer and we drive out there. Just as I roll up, my Kirim officer, who has the rifle, we already had another rifle already in place at the front of the house. So he's going to go and run down the street and go around the block and cover the backside of the yard off of Jameson.
Okay. And
I start talking to the sergeant saying, "Okay, what do we got?" The airship's over there going chop, 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 chop. He just told me what I just told you. That's pretty much the gist of it. And just as I start to say, "Hey, well, do we know if there's anybody in the house? Do we have a barricaded suspect? You know, do we need to call SWAT?" All those kind of things were going through my mind as a supervisor, because now I'm the incident commander and I've got to basically lay out the plan of not just how the officers are going to respond, but how many follow-on units are going to come and all that. And I'll get into that. Really, it was kind of interesting the way everything panned out. So then just as I'm talking to the sergeant, Leibowitz comes running out the front door of the house, blasting the shotgun, blam, blam, blam. I don't even know how many shots were fired. So there was a couple officers that were set up across the street behind some trees and a block wall. And they opened fire. Okay. So this guy Leibowitz is running forward with a shotgun. And the only thing he has on, he's got no shirt, he's got no shoes, and he's wearing a tracksuit. Like, you know, like the bros, like Russian mafia guys wear.
Right, right.
And he skids to a stop right at the curb, just off the onto the curb, onto the street, skids to a stop, and his pants drop to his ankles. and he's sporting a raging hard on as big as my arm.
Oh shit, really?
Oh, yeah.
So they shoot and he falls to the ground. But we don't see any blood. No blood whatsoever. So he's laying there and he's got his arms across his chest like this, like, and he's laying there like in a like he's in a coffin in like a he's like playing possum. And the shotgun's laying right next to him. Exactly 6 minutes go by. And we're figuring out how to set up an arrest team, you know, and roll up and move up. And I get on there, get on the air, and I request additional units. I set up an area for a rescue ambulance, an RA, where they should stage, where CP is going to be, all those kind of things. I put in a call to our union to get the lawyers rolling for the shooting.
Right. Yeah.
And then I call my captain's office to talk to my lieutenant, tell him, hey, look, advise everybody in the world, this is what's going on.
Right, because it went from dynamic to kind of static because he's been laying there for 6 minutes and he's not listening to commands or whatever, so you have time to then call in some resources to kind of get the ball rolling for what you already know is coming down the pipe.
Exactly. So maybe four or five coppers show up. I don't know why nobody from any outside the divisions came, but I think there might have been a help call in Foothill at the same time. I don't know. So nobody from outside my division showed up. So a couple of people from like the J car, the juvenile detective car, some other people showed up. So I had maybe six or eight people there at the scene at all, total, not including the sergeants. Mm-hmm. Another sergeant rolled up and he brought his car. We're going to use that as a cover to approach and handcuff him and get him away from the shotgun. Right.
Smart.
The reason I say 6 minutes, which is really, it was very surreal. Because 6 minutes is exactly the time in my head. I knew it was 6 minutes. And it's exactly based on this audio recording that we're going to play. 6 minutes went from the first shooting where we shot him and he fell to the ground to the second time when he started to get up. So 6 minutes go by. We decide we're going to create an arrest team. We start rolling up and I look around and I don't have enough people to even go and handcuff this guy and drag him away. I literally do not have enough people. So I have a sergeant driving the black and white. I have a sergeant directing the people that are behind cover, the covering officers with the rifles and the shotgun and what have you. And there's like three other people, and that's me. So I yell at this one officer, Hey, River, Rios, come over here. And he's like, Sarge, I got my shot on him, Sarge. No, get over here. Help us. So I end up grabbing a leg. But before I grab the leg, here's what happens. We start to approach. We're creeping up with the car. We're behind the car, kind of to the right. So the car's, it's a north-south street. And so we're facing south towards Ventura Boulevard, right? And it's on the west side of the street. And so the car, so we're kind of between the car and the curb. And then we're approaching, slowly approaching, using the car as cover. And just as we pull up, the sergeant who's directing everything, he yells out, "Hope, stop, back up. He's starting to get up, stop, back up." And he backs up. We back up. And then it was just sad and surreal. Is Leibowitz got up in a semi seated up position, and the sergeant is yelling at him, "Dude, don't go for that shotgun. Don't go for that shotgun. Don't go for that shotgun." And he turned and smiled at us and he grabbed the shotgun.
So had he been hit before?
He had been hit before, but he was internally bleeding. We didn't know. We didn't know he had been hit at all. We thought he might have been playing possum. So after that first shooting, the kid room officer, he comes running back because he had heard the shots. He had not quite gotten into position yet. So he came running back up the street, and then he got into a position to cover as a covering officer. And so then now we backed up, and the sergeant's giving the guy instructions, don't reach for that shotgun. Don't reach for that shotgun. And he reached for the shotgun, and the kid room officer fires one round with his UPR dead center mass and takes him down. So then, once again, we're going to form this arrest team to come in, pull him away from the shotgun. And I look around, and there's nobody there. So I'm like, hey, I tell this one officer, grab a leg. I'm going to grab the other leg. We're going to pull it away. And so we rolled up. We pulled his leg up pulled him away from the shotgun, secured that scene. But now think about it, as a as an officer and as a supervisor, what else do we have there, Chuck? Tom? We've got some other scene there, right?
Right.
We got a house. We haven't cleared a house.
Two crime scenes. You have the interior and the exterior crime scene.
We might have a dead
You don't know what you have in the house at this point.
Exactly. We might have a dead girlfriend. That's what we expected. So we go and we go clear the house. And
well, based on the information you had, that's what I would. I mean, you'd be like, okay, this guy comes out. Suicide by cop, and there's a gun shot that's in the house that starts this whole thing. Yeah. You're starting to
kind of like,
we're going to find,
kind of akin to what Matt's story was about. Remember?
Right.
You know, similar.
Yep.
So here's the ironic part, or not, I guess it's not funny, not ironic. I don't know how to describe it. A little more to the surreal. So we go to clear the house, and of course my phone is exploding. People are trying to call me. And so we just finished clearing the house, and I get on the phone, answer the phone, and it's my lieutenant, and I'm telling him, yeah, we just cleared the house. There's nobody here. We can't even find where he shot the shotgun in the house. And
oh, shit.
So I come back out of the house, and the criminal officer comes up to me, and he's obviously, you know, very stressed about the situation. And he's like, oh, I got to, you know, I said, you know, he's like, oh, I got to review our use of force policy. And I'm like, yeah, don't worry. I've got attorneys coming. The lead's got us covered. We'll be okay. Don't worry. I got all under control. And I said, and I always carry a copy of our use of force policy in my pocket. And I reached to go in my pocket. And then I realized my tape recorder was there. And just before I did that, though, I said to him, I'll just use the word B. I said to the officer, I said, you're my fucking hero. Because I could tell he was really, you know, traumatized by what happened. I said, dude, you're my fucking hero. And I pull out my tape recorder and I look and I see it's still running. And I go, it's now 11:30, click.
Mm-hmm.
So now everything's done.
You had no idea that was running the whole time.
No, I had no, I forgot. I had turned it on to deal with some citizen at the front desk.
I want to say one thing to you as a supervisor. And this is for other supervisors who are people who are looking to become supervisors. The one thing that he did that makes the officer feel that he's going to be okay is when he said, you're going to be my hero. I don't know about Tom's shooting, but when I got into a shooting, I was freaking the fuck out and like, oh fuck, I just smoked someone. And I look over at my supervisor who's there and he goes, you did a good fucking job. Good job. And then I was like, holy shit. Okay. And that made me feel at that point, okay, this is going to be okay. I did the right thing. So if it's a righteous shooting and a good shooting, it's okay to tell your officer, hey, you did a good job. You're okay. Or you're my hero or whatever, because what that officer, if you've never been through a shooting, is going through is a lot. Their fucking brain is going a mile a minute and they don't have a time to have a clear fucking thought. And I'm pretty sure Tom, when he went through his shooting, the same thing, his brain was probably going a mile a minute. And that's having a supervisor there to like reaffirm and tell you everything's going to be okay without being like, hey bud, everything's going to be okay, just by saying a couple few key words, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, they didn't send a supervisor to me. They said, do you need a supervisor? And I said, no, I'm good. And they're like, okay. And nobody from my agency came down. And
no way.
You know, but I had my homies. They know who they are. One of them lives near me now. Retired.
Awesome, dude.
And he was there and he was like, it's whatever you need, dude. I got you. And so
was that the homie that came to your house not too long ago?
Yep.
Yeah. That's awesome, dude. Oh yeah.
Anyway, but so you're thinking in terms of your officer and you're talking to him and he's having this moment and that's, you're there to kind of reassure him. You're there to what are you thinking as a supervisor right there?
Oh, you know, honestly, I'm thinking we've got a whole lot of stuff going on all at once. And besides him being in the situation he's in, we got a crime scene to manage. We've got more resources coming. We know Force Investigation Division, the guys who investigate, they're going to come. The bureau chief's going to come. The captains are going to come. And so there's going to be a public safety statement that's going to have to be made. Also,
within 3 days, I think.
Also, the fact that I had this recording and I had a dilemma. I had a dilemma, an internal ethical dilemma. Do I tell anybody I have this recording? Because other than the kit room officer, no one knew I had this recording.
Right, because so this is before cameras.
This is before Body One Video, yes. And so I didn't have to, like, I had an ethical duty to say I had it. How that was going to play out, I didn't know at that time. So, you know, whenever a critical incident happens, there's protocols in place that they separate all the involved people. There's percipient witnesses, means that you saw or heard the event. And then you have the actual people that are involved that did the actual shooting. We had multiple shooters there too. You know, a couple other officers that were identified in this LA Times article. So, you know, there's a lot going on there. And I knew that at pretty much I was not going to be the only person managing the crime scene. Matter of fact, I wasn't even going to be managing the crime scene anymore.
Right. You didn't own this for long.
At the moment, I didn't even think about it, but I knew there was going to be somebody, a captain or a deputy chief or whoever's going to be there. They're going to say, and I think it was Moore that showed up, actually. He was our bureau chief. He says, well, you know, so-and-so's the incident commander now. Okay, cool. But a couple of weird things happened, though. A couple of officers that were supposed to be there, like, disappeared when things started getting south. No, I'm just tapping my fingers.
Oh, it's very loud.
they disappeared.
That's some aggressive typing.
They were supposed to be like securing the perimeter. And when we turned and look around and helping run the CP, when we turned and look around, they were nowhere to be found. Like, they got in their car and they left.
That's interesting. That's odd behavior for patrol cops.
No, this person was assigned to the juvenile car. I had known this person for a very long time. I'd actually worked patrol with her. But it was like, after this incident, and I never even confronted her about it or anything, but after that incident, she kind of knew that what she did, and she just decided to go back to the station. Didn't want any part of the play, I guess.
Yeah. Wow.
That's been known to happen on occasion.
Dude, that's a common occurrence in use of forces and things that turn south, you know, go sideways pretty quick. People fucking vanish. They're ghosts, dude. I mean, when I got injured, that happened to me. There was supervisors coming up to me and telling me, we watched 5 cars turn around and drive away. I mean, I was like, cool, dude. Yeah. That's fucking piss poor. But hey,
I don't get it.
I don't get it at all.
What do you mean? Anyway.
Exactly.
So a bunch of our detectives came out to, supervising detectives came out to sit with individual officers. So we couldn't, you know, and we never really, we're not, you know, some doohickey organization. We're not going to bring our stories together or anything. There's nothing to do with like that. But I had that ethical dilemma. Do I tell this detective that was sitting with me that I have this audio recording? Or do I just wait till everything gets, you know, everybody shows up and they sit us down at the station and they start to talk to us, that I pull this out? So I said, no. So I said to himself, I'm going to tell him right now. And he's like, oh, hey, cool. That's great. Let's not touch it. Let's wait till the investigators get here. And then the investigators got there and said, we're not going to touch it either. Let's get our SID guys, our lab guys to go. And the first thing they did when we got back to the station was burn like 6 copies of the CD. So we can, and then, which is really kind of neat. Most crime scenes, especially officer involved shooting scenes, there you're talking about 24 to 48 hours of a scene being held, right? Where you know, walking the distance of the street and counting all the shell casings and everything that is involved in there. You know, it's a pretty long process. Take a guess in the number of hours it took to wrap up this crime scene. Six hours.
Oh, you said six minutes earlier when it was a big deal, so I guess six.
6 hours. Yeah. I would say estimate about 6 hours.
So,
it happened around 11 o'clock and 11:30 and it was done within before dark.
So I'm still in suspense. What the hell happened inside the house?
Exactly what I was about to ask, dude. Reading my mind.
I think you probably just fired off a round. Maybe an accident.
Into where?
Intentional discharge. We don't know.
You never searched the house and found it like
we did. We searched. We didn't see any. We couldn't find
any. No. Any gunshot? Any shotgun shell? Nothing.
I can't remember if there was if we found a shotgun shell or not. I can't remember that.
What if it? I mean, it must have been in the air.
Why? What did this dude decide to die for?
Well, if you do any research on him, his brother did a few years later, his twin brother did I guess he calls it a thesis on his evil Eric.
He did it straight. Good twin, bad twin, good yes. brother, evil brother.
But I do remember because, you know, they were guests on the Howard Stern show. And a couple of days after this happened,
his
brother Jeffrey was talking to Howard Stern on the news or on Howard Stern's show. And Howard Stern stood up for us when he said, oh, LAPD murdered my brother. And Howard Stern said, no, I don't think so. Your brother had, you know, some issues and your brother got what was coming to him. It was,
shit, dude.
Kudos to Howard Stern.
Said that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, Tom's face said it exactly what I was saying on the inside, dude.
I used to have a lot of respect for Howard Stern. He's a chump now.
Back in the day, he was fucking awesome. You're like, that guy is fucking punk rock. And now you're like,
dude, it's the same thing as Rage Against the Machine. Rage Against the Machine should be called Sold Out the Machine.
I can't even listen to their shit. They come on the radio and I'm just like, boop, skip. Yeah. You know, the Amazon, Apple radio.
Howard Stern used to be all about fight the man, fight the power, and then he became the man.
Just like Green Day do.
Yeah, I know.
So some of that. So
hard to be punk rock when you're rich.
There's another page that I found about the biography of the two brothers, and the reviews were given from like, here's one that said, you guys are banned from the NBC lot. I guess they were on the Tonight Show once. You guys are banned from the NBC lot. I hope you have good luck with your fucking career, Jay Leno. And then another one, I did like their music, but they started insulting Ozzy Osbourne.
How were these guys on the Tonight Show?
They were the Jesus Twins. They were a band called the Jesus Twins.
The Jesus?
So they were famous?
A singing duo, yeah.
Type that shit up, Tom.
Yeah, I'm bringing it up right now.
You pull up some fucking audio from these fucking weirdos?
Well, so this is from Carrie Del Abbott, producer of the Howard Stern Show. They really are the world's biggest jerks. They think they're stars. They're frightening.
We're the Jesus Twins. Yeah, here's all their stuff on Howard Stern.
It's the first time we ever played a song on the air, and the two artists got up and tried to beat up Fred.
What? These guys sound unhinged.
Yeah. I mean, one of them is dead, so fuck them.
Were they in an affluent neighborhood of West Valley?
Oh, yeah, in Encino. See, but if you know that part of Encino, it's where they had the small 2 and 3 bedroom houses that were built right after World War II for the GIs. So they're just tract homes, old small little tract homes that are, you know, kind of condensed in an area south of Victory Boulevard and north of Ventura Boulevard.
Okay, I love this. This is how the LA Times wrote it up. Eric Lewis Leibowitz, 35, a white man, was shot and killed by Los Angeles police officers in the 5800 block of Falcom Avenue.
A white man.
That's how they put it. Eric Lewis Leibowitz, 35, a white man, was shot and killed by Los Angeles. Hey, guys, LAPD shot a white dude. Oh, let's see.
For the first time or something like that? Or is that the way it sounds like? Oh, they finally got a whitey.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if there's anyone.
So what happened though is after we kind of wrapped up the crime scene, which was really bizarre. I don't know about you, Chuck, but they took a mugshot of every one of us out at the scene. They had us stand up against a wall of a side of a garage and just got headshots of everybody that was involved.
Interesting.
Including recipient witnesses.
When I was, I don't know.
For the GA, I guess.
Tom, did you ever have to take photographs at scene when you got involved in OIS?
No.
So we took some, I think we took a photograph, but I don't remember taking fucking like mugshot photos when I got into an OIS. I do know that there were plates on the ground, like white fucking plates. This is like the one thing I remember because I was tired as fuck. I was up for over 24 hours when I got in, like, back to scene. And I remember looking at like these Dixie plates with like names on the fucking ground.
Where
they're like,
where you were standing.
This is where you were standing, right? And I was like, no, this is where I was standing. Oh, okay, cool, 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 cool. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Is weird. But I don't remember ever taking like mugshot photos or anything like that. But I could have just been so exhausted. But I've been involved in so many like categorical use of forces and like stuff where, you know, our type of force investigations division, science investigation division came out and, you know, lined us up on plates and shit like that and stuff like that. I'm trying to remember on the three or four that I was involved in, if I ever had to take any type of like mugshot photos. I don't think I ever did, but I could be really mistaken because every single time that happened, it always happens towards the end of watch and you're always extended over and you're always up for over 24 hours. So everything is kind of like a fucking blur when you're trying to remember it at that point, which is honestly like, this is food for thought. If you're involved in an officer involved shooting or some sort of categorical fucking incident where you have a force investigation division or a science investigation division come out to like do all this shit, you should probably, because they're going to ask you, do you think you're okay right now to give a statement? And you just want to get it over with and done with. You're like, yeah, absolutely. I've been on Monsters all fucking night and Rock Stars or Bangs or whatever. And take a fucking breath and be like, you know what? I think I should probably go home, take a fucking siesta, a little nap for like 6 hours. And then we can come back and we can do it later tonight or we can do it tomorrow. I know you don't want to relive it. I know you don't want to relive it, but getting a little bit of a catnap will make you think so much clearer and make you articulate so much better. Yeah. And if I could have redone any of those incidents of categorical incidents that I was involved in where I had to be interviewed and shit like that, and I should have learned off the fucking first one, I would have taken that extra, you know, can I go home and take like a 8 hour nap, 6 hour nap? Yeah. Come back thinking about it now, you know, hindsight's 2020. But you know, it's a food for thought. You do with it with what you will, but I think it's a good idea.
So here's
what they did real quick though, before you start that. So what they did is we went back to West Valley Station and we went up in detectives and they had us in a conference room, all the precipient witnesses, all the people that didn't shoot. And then all the people that shot were in another room and they played the audio. And then after we played the audio, then they basically built their scenario or built the chronology of the incident from the audio, and it helped them immensely.
Yeah,
that's why things were wrapped up so quick.
Because you get to refresh your memory as opposed to trying to remember things. When you listen to it back with fresh ears and a fresh brain, you can make notes and go, yep, 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 yep. So this is
on the way there, the officer was driving in the wrong direction and we had turning around and going another direction. And I'm yelling and screaming when I found out the address. And I'm like, this is the asshole house. This is the asshole house. I had the wrong house. There was another house on Belcombe that was the asshole house. So my captain later said, yeah, that probably we're not going to talk about that.
All right. So here we go. So you hear the code, Robert.
Got eyes on him? Sounds like they got eyes on him.
What? Stand by, stand by.
Watch out. He's holding his body across his arms. Watch him. Watch him. Shut fire. Hold still.
Stand by.
So at that point, I mean,
you can hear the airship fucking washing out the sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we fast forward it the 6 minutes to hear the second round, the second volley of gunfire?
I think you could, yeah.
So just that's the first volley.
Yeah, take it from the time, yeah, from that.
Okay. So we're at
my black and white
with the RA. Me and RA.
Yeah, let me speak to Lieutenant Gazar.
That's my phone call to the captain's office.
Good figure radio communication.
That's the airship.
You need to go get him. This is starting to handle it much better. You need to get him. You need to go get him. You need to have him come out to the call out on Balfour.
You need to go get him.
South of Oxnard. We got an officer involved shooting. We still haven't cleared the house either.
Oh, that's why we're not moving. All right. Let them go. Rules, you know what to do. Hey, Sarge, do get an RA to respond 1 North.
1 North?
Yeah, 1 North either. Stand by. You got to keep focusing on the
power. So is it?
I'm going to get an RA unit for a male adult, conscious, breathing, suffering from a gunshot wound. I want the RA to respond on Hatteras, just east of Balco. Standby.
So that's the staging area, which is just off of like White Oak Avenue.
Channel 10, I also need an additional unit to stand by with the RA. Approach from White Oak on Hatteras, east of Balcom.
That's it. Put the intersection right where it belongs, you know?
It's like, don't do it. I hear, don't do it.
Oh, here we go.
My black light. McDonald. Where's McDonald?
So how far are you from the suspect at this point?
25 yards, maybe a little less.
So close.
Yeah. It was really, everything was really close.
Sorry, we don't know where this is going to happen, so I don't want to fast forward.
I want you covering the truck. McDonald was coming his way, and I don't know where he went. Let's go back to cover the house again.
Probably go 10 seconds.
Back to place.
Okay.
Back's got a headshot.
So he's where?
He's going to roll. He's going to roll towards that.
That's the supervisor. That's the other sergeant.
Headshot.
I mean, yeah, at that point, that's what you have to consider if he's still...
Yeah.
And this is why they're still a threat until they're not a threat, right?
Exactly.
For those of you listening to this, they are still a threat until they are not a threat. This dude's, I can just imagine, he's laying there. He knows he's hit, right? I'm sure at some point he decided, I'm going to die.
I remember now, he's still laying there with a giant heart on, Still got a hard on the whole time.
Take some fucking Viagra, dude. He has got. He's got to go to the hospital.
He's waiting for it. The internal bleeding hasn't reached his hard on yet.
Set up our CP on Hatteras, east of Belk.
Don't touch the shotgun.
Here we go.
Everyone shooting back. They come out. All the way to the shotgun.
Rios.
I heard the shots.
Yep.
Flannery. Rios.
That's the airship.
Right.
That sounded like two shots were fired.
Yep.
Yeah.
It might have been two. I don't know.
It was two. You could hear it.
Yeah. I heard pow, pow. And you hear them say, don't go near the shotgun. Don't grab the shotgun.
Yep. That's good communication right there.
Never learn.
Like, if we were going to debrief this. I mean, the good communication, good setup, good patience, good waiting, good tactical communication, good plans. Everything was done pretty fucking textbook on at that point. I mean, you could argue the fact, hey, why didn't you go up sooner? You know, well, you're trying to develop a plan, you know, so that you can do it safely. But I think right. It was a great shoot. Yeah.
I mean, what else are you going to do at that point? You've given him every chance.
Can you fast forward it up to the last, like, say 10 seconds? Play the last 10
as long
seconds.
As it doesn't give anything away.
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't know.
Well, that's why we can't. I don't want it to give anything away. So, I think it's interesting for me to hear if you're rolling there as a supervisor and you're going there knowing that you're not going to. I mean, everybody knows I famously call sergeants base coaches. You're wearing the uniform and you're on the field, but you're not actually playing the sport, right?
Sometimes, and you're not supposed to, but you know the temptation's there, though.
Right.
To do work.
So, you know, you are rolling there from the perspective of, thinking about that 30,000 foot view, right? That overarching look at the entire situation, and you have to think about your officer. You have to think about the community. You have to think about, unfortunately, the chief's ass. You know, you have to. You have to think about all these damn things. And then you also know that ultimately it's not going to fall on you unless you screw something up in that brief window of time where you have control before all the other teams start showing up. Right.
Right.
And that's kind of what I did at some point, insert myself, because I had no bodies. In a way, though, it actually made the scene more controllable. The fact that I didn't have 30 people from other divisions going, hut, let's go in there. Where are we going to, where'd I set up? And we just had our people, only our people. And we had what we had. We didn't have any more, didn't have any less. And so, I ended up grabbing a leg, you know, so I grabbed a leg. But after I grabbed the leg, I reverted right back to supervisor mode. And when we went in and stacked up and went and searched the house, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like a blessing in disguise. You know, you didn't have too many, you know, hands in the pot from other divisions, you know, and stuff like that. So it makes things a lot cleaner, especially for you and as well as for the FID and SID.
So, you know, the way LAPD works is after an officer-involved shooting, a critical incident like that, they have like a, I don't know if it's 72 hours or 48 hours or a week. They've got to do a brief to the chief, and they got to do a brief to the police commission. And mm-hmm. And then afterwards, after it goes to a forced review committee that sits down there and looks at it, and that's after then they decide if they're going to present a case to the DA to decline filing or not file, even though it was clearly a justifiable homicide. They still mm-hmm. go through the motions of all that stuff, and then finally they'll always these use of force review committee. Is generally made up of a peer, which is a usually an officer, and then usually higher ranking supervisors, lieutenants, captains, and commanders. And they usually always have to add their little, oh, we could have done this better. We could have done that better. And why didn't you do this? And why didn't you do that? And so when there was a very famous guy in our tactics section, he's passed on now, a guy named Frank Micah. He was a legend on LAPD as far as tactical shooting. And he gave us our debrief. And it was all of us, including including the shooters. And he sat us down and said, this is what you guys did good. And this is what you guys did so-so. And then he said, this was one of the few shootings where the only critique that these people up in the higher offices had to say was this one officer, before the first shooting happened, stepped away from his cover behind a tree to identify himself. And he said he should have never have left cover. They had no other critique, not anything that we did from start to finish.
Well,
and I think, and for
LAPD, that's a huge endorsement because they'll nitpick. Well, it was a different time. And I know we say that because
nobody
won 16 years ago, but it was a different time 16 years ago.
Oh, for sure. And I guarantee if they would have had body worn, they would have nitpicked the fuck out of you guys.
Oh, it would have been, oh, he scratched his nose. And why is he standing over there? And why is he looking at his phone? And you know, it would have been a mess.
Yeah.
But everybody was honest, but you know, that it still comes down to integrity. We all had integrity except for the one officer I said disappeared. But, but looking back in hindsight, I mean, I think I could have probably done a better job. I deliberately made sure that when I put out the broadcast for the additional units to set up the CPE and to set up for, you could even hear it in my voice. I'm making pauses. Like I'm pausing in my voice to say Hatteras east of Balcom, enter from White Oak Avenue, just so that would be nice and clear. It was, you know, because we all kind of do that when we get excited, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you have to slow yourself down sometimes to go normal speed.
And that's why it was so surreal to me, because of that 6-minute window that I'm telling you about, how six minutes went by from the first one. And then I get on the phone and then I get on the radio and I start directing units. And I still have the sergeant at the scene. And I still have the sergeant at the scene who's doing the actual tactical side of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you could hear me say at one time, I said, you know, where's this officer? And he's like, I got him already set up. You know,
right.
I'm like, I didn't know
he was there. I got two things for you there, Walt. One, what do you think that other people who are getting ready to become supervisors or already supervisors, what advice could you give them regarding something like this? And then two, we'll get into your dedication.
You could never 100% prepare for something like this, but I can tell you, have a mindset that just because the tactical situation's over, it's not going to be over. Don't second guess yourself. Do what you need to do in the moment. Take care of your people. And if you the one thing that I wouldn't even call it a fault, you know, like we talk about, oral interviews. So tell us what your greatest weakness is. Oh, my greatest weakness is I care too much, you know.
Right,
but bullshit. I think as a supervisor and as a sergeant, I always took the troops were first to me. It was always the troops. Nice. And that's why later on in my career, I made some enemies, because I was always going to do what's best for the troops, even if somebody else wanted me to do something different. If I was within policy, I chose the way for the troops every time.
Right.
That's that military in you.
No. Yeah, but I was on the Air Force, man. Come on.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't mean there can't be tricks in the Air Force.
Yeah, I was living a dream, man. I lived it, and I love. I feel so blessed.
Well, you have to come back and tell us some of your stories, some of your capers, because I know you've been around a while, and you've got some good ones.
I got some great ones. So my dedication?
Yes.
So my dedication is to an old Air Force Air National Guard buddy of mine, James Clark Bea. His grandfather was a motor cop on LAPD. And on June 7th, 1988, the night of June 6th to June 7th, he was a rookie 4 months out of the academy working North Hollywood division, and responded to a burglary in progress call at an electronic shop. some gang members were breaking into the shop. And back then, they weren't so tight about separating from your partner. A lot of times what would happen is if you gave chase, your partner would go back and get the car, and then they'd run right down. So Jimmy Bea was killed in the line of duty. What happened was he encountered the suspect in the bushes, and as his partner was rolling up in the black and white, he lost control of his weapon. The suspect shot him in the leg with his own weapon and shot him in the head and killed him. And then in 2015, I had a memorial walk dedicated in his honor in Reseda, a couple blocks from my old house by West Valley Station, as a tribute to him, as an honor, a memorial walk in his honor. I went to high school with his cousin, and wow, it really hit me hard that day. I mean, when I heard about it on the news.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I'll never forget him. Every year I go to Sacramento. Thomas was up in Sacramento with me, and every mm-hmm. year I go to Sacramento, and I've been to DC twice. Lest we forget, we always honor our fallen. Always.
Yep. Yes, we do. Well,
I miss you guys. Honestly, I miss all you guys.
Being stupid and doing the job.
Yeah, that too. But you know, I miss, you know, I'm gonna have to go down south and go see Marco, and have some lunch.
Have him give you a tattoo.
I'm done with tattoos, bro.
You're the only person I know that gets started. You get started on tattoos and then gets tired of it. Everybody else, you just keep going.
My two chick tattoos on my ankles. That's what I like. My religious symbols. Yeah, but these, when you look at pictures back in the day when you're young and you don't have all this junk, it's like,
well, that was shit ink.
What?
It turned, you know, the ink turns green. The old ink back in the day.
No, that's a tattoo. That's green. It's a green dragon.
That's a green dragon, bro. It's a Celtic knot, man. The peeps.
All right. Well, Officer Bea, best easy brother. We got it from there. I've seen the walk. It's a beautiful tribute to him, and I'm sure he's proud of what you've done for him.
I still want to go to Police Week in this DC. We should do war stories out there. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I'd like to go this year if I could. I mean, I've got to get a second job now because I spent money building a garage and now I don't have enough money to go on vacation anywhere.
Well, Chuck, what do you have for us?
Well, I want to say thank you, Walt, for coming out and speaking your story and telling your story. We look forward to having you on for many more. I want to say thank you, everyone, for listening. Like today's podcast, please like and subscribe to us. You can help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcast or really whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. We're on available major podcast streaming platforms as well as on YouTube. Rating and reviewing is how we grow. It beats the algorithm. It helps us grow the podcast and gets us into the ears of more people. If you already follow us on Instagram and Facebook, please like and share our post. Our Instagram is @war_stories_official. And our Facebook is @war_stories_podcast. We have a link there. You can grab the link and you can get to all of our socials, our media. You can also support us by going to www.warstoriesofficial.com. And you can grab some gear. If you think you have a story you want to tell, you can go to booking.warstories@gmail.com and I can get you booked. We're always looking for veterans, law enforcement, firefighters, medics, but also corrections, dispatchers, and nurses. If you have a friend who you think would be a great fit for us, please give them our booking email. Again, that is booking.warstories@gmail.com. I can get you guys booked and link them up with us, tell them about us, and then give them our booking email, and we can go from there. Thank you.
Yep. I'm a fan of your show, too, by the way.
Great. I'm a fan.
You're a fan of the show? Well, yes, I am. I'm glad. I would hope that you would be a fan. Until our next episode, we'll have Walter back on another one to tell us some actual stories. We can swap stories about each other in our younger days. But until our
that's
next
for episode, locker that's for a locker room, right?
Well, we have to be very careful about guests on locker room because we haven't had some great luck of late.
Oh,
but until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.